This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Bruschi, Stacey Cole, and Todd Michaels.
Yeah, I think that it's just such a different time that we live in that it's you have to be cognizant of what's going on around you. And like Stacey said, you know, using kind of the example of, you know, a wife who's got a husband that's kind of curled up at the other end of the couch all the time and seems to be texting somebody, and you're like, "Oh, who the fuck are you texting, dude?" No one. Yeah. Man. I'm just texting Jim, you know, and then the wife has to creep in the phone because she's, you know, it's got major red flags, and women can typically sense when their dude's doing some shit like that.
Sure.
And, you know, and with parents, it's easier. I know that kids should have privacy to a certain extent, but at the same time, they're still children. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm my 13-year-old, we track exactly who she can and can't text. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, it's got to go through. So we, you know, she was begging. I want to be on Snapchat. All my friends are on Snapchat, you know, so then we have to research how do we control keeping creeps out, you know, so. Because they're out there. I mean, the predators in terms of online is where it's really, really scary.
It is.
That's harder to monitor than the things that are going on in real life. Now, I mean, with like Sandra's case, everybody let her down. Like every single person that was an adult that was involved in her life. And again, like I'm with you, Tony, I'm not blaming the parents, but every single person that was an adult in that child's life let her down.
Yeah.
And, you know, and it turned out the worst way possible. So,
I mean, it literally took civil litigation to uncover the foundational pattern of a crime.
Yeah.
That the initial, there really wasn't a criminal investigation in any of this. It was all completely overlooked. How often is that where it takes the civil litigation to finally unearth the reality of what took place here?
I mean, I wouldn't pretend to know the exact answer to how frequently that is, but when you get a case where you've gone to where there's been an outcry of some sort, and typically what they'll do is they'll bring you if your child makes an outcry, and they'll say, okay, we're going to bring you in for a what they call a CAC interview, which is the child advocacy. And they have different names for them all over. Mm-hmm. But in Illinois, they call it the Child Advocacy Center. And essentially, you're meeting there with somebody who's trained to try to elicit information in terms of what the outcry is. They're typically not straight up law enforcement, but they're law enforcement adjacent. And they are not usually in a room with a cop, because they're trying to get information from that child. But the first thing you have to do is you have to build rapport, and you want that child to feel comfortable to the extent where they're going to be open and honest about, you know, what they're saying happened. Mm-hmm. So if you have that type of situation where you go in and you do the CAC interview and they don't feel that they have enough and they don't bring a case, that's where you'll see these civil cases kind of pop up. And, you know, you'll go after them. And that's cases where you have families that don't think that they're getting justice and that law enforcement isn't doing it from, you know, their perspective, what they should be doing. And so then you bring the civil suit in order to try to shine more light on it. Because there's two parts of it, right? There's the money part. You know, if it doesn't involve some famous singer or some shit like we've been seeing recently, you know, and you're bringing suit for two purposes, one to out that singer or that artist or actor or whatever it may be, or somebody of note. And, you know, you want the cash and you want to flamethrow them both. So it serves both purposes civilly. And what you hope, and because we saw that's exactly what we saw with Diddy, right? I mean, it was like it had to be the civil suits that finally got the feds. Say, all right, you know, we're going to take a look at this. And that's typically where it is. If you have a situation where state law enforcement agencies are just refusing to do anything about it, you know, filing those suits, especially if you file them in federal court, are a pretty good way. And even in state court, but it's going to put it on the radar of the feds in terms of, okay, what's going on here. So, yeah. I mean, it's an avenue. It's an avenue for victims to try to get their cases on law enforcement's radar, because I think that people just misconstrue exactly, you know, how you go about getting law enforcement to try to really do something about what you're claiming is happening. So,
and how are you going to get law enforcement to look into this when it's their own officer that, that they really need to be looking at, which is what exactly happened here. Local police department investigated one of its own, almost immediately ruled the death of suicide, case closed. So the civil suit opens up, and then that gets the feds looking at it. Ultimately, we go back to a medical examiner ruling this a suicide. Now, the medical examiner, it's not the officer. It's not Michael Farwell's not the one who ruled it a suicide. A medical, so another person has to be involved in this process. How the hell did that break down so much where the medical examiner is saying, yes, this is a suicide, despite when they look back later, oh, wait a second, her bones broken in her neck, there's signs of strangulation, there's all this other evidence around that point to it not being, but somehow somebody checked that box right when it took place. How do we get to that place? And then why is there no accountability for any of this? Because it clearly looks like, well, somebody along the line either made a really horrible judgment call on the death, or there was a reason they made that very horrible judgment call. And it wasn't because of their judgment.
Yeah, no, I think that in the situation with the medical examiner, you know, when you have an ME in there doing an autopsy and there's a potential that it could be ruled a homicide, more often than not, you're going to have law enforcement in that room during the medical examiner's autopsy. And typically they're giving the ME information about what the scene looked like, you know, what they discovered at the scene in terms of, like, I mean, if they're going in there and they're saying, okay, well, there was a, you know, there was a length of rope strung from, you know, like a like whatever they were would have claimed that she had hung herself from, what some kind of thing, or a belt, or, you know, whatever they're claiming in terms of how she committed suicide, which obviously had to have been hanging herself, right? Because I mean, the strangulation part of it,
from a doorknob, right?
Right, whatever the case may be.
You can't hang yourself. Like, it's like, what?
Yeah, the whole point is that your fight or flight reflex can't be, you know, used in terms of, okay, I'm now sitting on the floor, I'm choking to death, I'm going to stand up because my body's going to make me do it. So that doesn't work, right? I mean, that's why people hang from a height, so that the feet can't touch. So yeah, that should have been a red flag for ME. But I mean, the best I could guess, if it's from the just completely whiffed on the cause of death from the ME's perspective, is that they were fed information by whatever cop or cops were sitting in that autopsy with them during the autopsy. And they're like, all right, well, I'm going to rule it, you know, self-harm.
Yeah.
And if it's the other thing, then that's a whole different thing. Right.
And I think that there's an interesting piece to that too, because just as Farwell could have groomed and did groom Sandra Birchmore, could have groomed the medical examiner. 100%. Could have groomed, I mean, not necessarily in the same way, but they were manipulated, I guess, would be more of the correct word to use in that sort of a context. But if it's a small town, everybody knows each other. The cops know the medical examiner from many other cases here and there. You're rubbing elbows all the time. And if you're the medical examiner and you're not twisted and you're not the one that's thinking somebody is going to be, you know, skewing this for their own weird, dark murder plot that took place here, you may be thinking, this person I've been working with for years seems to be a nice guy. Maybe had lunch with him, maybe this or that. We see him around. You're not thinking that they'd be doing this sort of thing. You're not walking in with that expectation. Just the same way, you know, 14-year-old Sandra is not thinking, this guy is going to try and sleep with me. You know, the same way any young person, same way I at 14, 15, didn't think the guy that wanted to go take me to have McDonald's had any sort of other intention than being a radio person and wanting to take me to McDonald's. And so you learn later, oh, these people have other fucked up intentions. So that medical examiner It doesn't always necessarily mean nefarious. It means they have a rapport with their coworkers, and this happens to be their job.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's easier to see that way.
But why didn't they look at the facts? I guess that's the thing. It's one thing to just go and say, well, and they said this, but when you look at the, if you actually look at the evidence of her, you can see it. Why did they just gloss it? Well, they said it's this. Well, maybe it was this. Is it, you're a medical examiner. There's certain things that can be explained and there's certain things that can't be explained.
Yeah.
Feels like a cover-up is what it feels like. I mean, at the end of the day, it feels like they were protecting their own.
It's a cover-up, but who's all involved in that cover-up, I guess, is a question. We know Farwell allegedly was, but was medical examiner, or was it exactly that? Just really sloppy work and going along, well, my colleague over here says this, well, I'm going to go with that. I trust them and blah, 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 done. Evidence be damned.
But that's what I'm saying, like that thing where I'm talking about during an autopsy and there's a cop in there.
Yeah.
It's your cops. Yeah, you are going to have that rapport. Yeah, you are going to have that relationship with them. And, you know, you're not necessarily, as the medical examiner, going to be challenging facts that they're telling you. I mean, Farwell went in there and he staged the thing to look like it was a, you know, that she had hung herself. I mean, a medical examiner isn't going to say, well, that sounds like bullshit. Based on what I'm seeing here on the table and what you're telling me you found there at the scene. Like, that's not their role.
Well, and does the MA even have knowledge to look at a scene like that and go, this seems fishy?
Not that I'm aware of. Typically, yeah. I mean, MEs will show up at scenes for sure. Mm-hmm. There's no question about it. And I think probably more often than not, if it's a scene wherein they're eventually going to be taking the bodies from the scene, the ME will show up. So in this case, I don't know if the ME ever showed up. If they went there, did their investigation, and then I would have assumed that when they decided to bring the body, like typically that's when the ME would come.
Yeah.
Is when they get the scene processed, the medical examiner then shows up, or the county coroner, whoever sure. it is that's dealing with it. And then I don't know if they're going in and examining the scenes.
Yeah. That's more of an investigative detective type work. And if those people that are doing that are the ones who perpetrated the crime,
that's how you see how this can happen. So I don't know. And I think it probably varies from jurisdiction to jurisdiction in terms of what MEs are doing. In terms of like, I don't think that they're going in and necessarily, but they might be because it's helpful. They should be, you know, cause they're a different breed than the cops. Like we should be able to rely on medical examiners because they're supposed to be completely unbiased and objective in terms of determining what the cause of death is. And the mode of death.
Look at Ellen Greenberg. I mean, there's a prime example of, wait a minute, this is supposed to be somebody who is, number one, a doctor, correct?
Right.
Yeah, I mean, your checks and balances go out the window when it's a good old boy system, which seems kind of like what this was. Well, I say it's this. Yeah, you're right, I believe. Like, when the one's not, because at the end of the day, the medical examiner didn't do their job. They did not get to the results that another autopsy got to.
Right.
And that's simply you didn't do your job.
Right.
I mean, are there any sort of consequence? I mean, I know there's probably not, and there usually isn't for many of these cases, but professional consequences a police department can face or the medical examiner can face when you got a federal investigation that proves that it actively ignored or covered up the evidence in the case other than Farwell, who we know has been charged, but the other ones, well, you're giving up your ability to be a police officer for the rest of your life because it turns out you were pretty shady in this whole passing the girl around thing. Granted, she was of age, and it does appear that it was consensual when she was of age, but the ickiness, the ick factor is all there because these people are all intertwined. They're all friends, and this has been going, and Farwell, at least, we know, have been doing this since she was 14.
Yeah.
And then to stage the thing, I mean, it makes everybody wonder, well, did they know what was going on here? Are they aware that this was a cover up of a murder? Do they really think that she killed herself? How deep do you think that this case went in terms of others being aware or at least suspicious?
Yeah.
That department that Farwell murdered her.
I think when you kind of look at it and when you were talking about it, it seems to be kind of in the same kind of little area in Massachusetts where all this shit goes down. You know, but you've got some of the same cops when you're talking about the communications between Birchmore and Farwell were, and we're talking like 60,000-70,000 text messages were somehow overlooked by one of the other cops in the department. You know, I mean, when that kind of stuff's going on, I mean, common sense is going to dictate like the jig is up. You know, when the feds saw it, they're like, I mean, because all the Karen Reed shit stemmed out of this case. Like, people that don't understand how that federal investigation into that department started, it was because of this case.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, from that, they're like, all right, well, this case is so fucked up. Like the way that like this is so twisted that we have to take a harder look at some of the other stuff that's going on, which, frankly, you want the feds doing. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't have some kind of blind trust in cops. I mean, sure. Fucking guys that went and got badges and went to a police academy and have a shit ton of power. I want oversight for them because I don't trust them, you know, mm-hmm. And that's not to say there's not amazing cops out there.
Sure.
But, you know, anytime somebody has that much power, you know, you need somebody keeping an eye on them, you know, and typically it's us defense attorneys in terms of when there's an arrest, making sure they're not out there violating people's rights. And, you know, calling them on that. But on the front end of it, you know, when they're out there doing their shit, I mean, other than internal affairs, I mean, who else is there? Which to me is still in-house.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? I know how you see it on TV shows that like all the cops hate IAB guys. Oh, you're fucking
it's still in-house.
Fuck you. You know, it's like, I don't believe that. It's still in-house. So I like. It's hard to say. And the other part of it is that you've got these police unions that are fierce. You know, it is really hard to fire a cop.
Yes.
You know, it just is. So, you know, I mean, they have to really, really fuck up in order for them to be discharged. So, you know, as far as the medical examiner, a lot of times they're elected.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, the county coroners are always elected. At least they are in our state. MEs, I think, could be fired if they've been hired. But in terms of kind of like trying to figure out where it fell apart in this case, I mean, there's all kinds of people to point your fingers at.
When checks and balances disappear, you do end up going down the conspiracy road because people are conspiring to cover something up.
Yeah. And I think it's like here it would have been after the fact. I think,
mm-hmm.
You know, initially Farwell was probably just, you know, doing this shit on his own accord. You know, maybe like you'd have to think, dude, some of his other cop buddies that were in the program with him, but like, dude, you're kind of fucking being creepy.
Yeah.
You know, with this chick, but
unless they're all being creepy too.
Exactly. Well,
but again, there's so much pressure within the ranks that even the good apple who's sitting there going, I don't like what I'm seeing. They may be so fearful of the process of the shit that's going to go down. Mm-hmm. If they, you know, raise their hand and say, I'm not okay with this because so many might be corrupt in the department that they're outnumbered.
Yeah. 100%. Like not only is that maybe that's absolutely the truth. Yeah.
And sometimes I imagine some of those folks feel like I there's this corruption everywhere. I'm one of the good ones, and they need some balance in here. They need some good people in here who can do what they can do within their power while still trying to keep their job and be able to be accountable for what's going on behind the scenes. You know, some people just trying to endure it like that. It's always interesting in cases like this where then you have weird behavior that goes on, like, you know, phones and things like that being destroyed or deleted or gone. And that ties into the Karen Reed case a bit. And I don't want to go super into Karen Reed, but when we see in that case, there were several of the officers, they all got rid of their phones at a certain point. Now, and many of those officers had really were not directly involved on this case, on the side of Birchmore at all. Right. But they did know people. They communicate. They text. They're there. So, you know, you're texting your your buddies, your colleagues, whatever, about stuff. You know, someone who may be involved in that could be texting stuff back and forth to people who are not on that case, but still wearing a badge. That's what I always suspected about that piece of that puzzle when we're talking about the Karen Reed connection, was that they're like, what are they getting rid of on their phones? And does it have anything to do with this case that we're talking about over here, which at the time was Karen Reed? It made me wonder, like, is this like there's a lot of shadiness here. So I'm going to guess there's a lot of things on these phones that probably connect to far other cases, far more cases than just the one at hand, and that they may have a vested interest in getting rid of because it will be unearthed because they were going to look at it for this case. Well, you may not find the evidence for it on this case, but you may end up opening an investigation to something else because of what you find on it because of that.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.